Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, Phoenix passes $60 million shade plan to plant 27,000 trees, replacing gold to shade 25% of the city, by Taylor Seeley. Phoenix says more trees and shade are coming over the next 5 years. The City Council approved the Shade Phoenix Plan on November 13th to plant 27,000 trees and build 550 shade structures. The vote replaced the City Council's original goal to shade 25% of Phoenix by 2030, which city staff has made no measurable progress on. The new plan includes a $60 million funding commitment and 37 action items that explicitly focus on the city's most vulnerable residents and the places where people are outside the most. The report emphasizes tree equity, which means planting trees in the areas that need it most, which are often lower-income areas. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego celebrated the new plan at Solano Elementary School on November 14th. Gallego said, "It's an exciting milestone along the way to our goal of increased tree shade cover and built shade structures in the parts of our city that need it most. Phoenix is the hottest big city in the country, but thankfully it's about to become a little cooler." Council members said they hoped staff would pay special attention to not only planting the trees, but also keeping them alive. "I do believe in this shade plan, but I want to make sure we are continuing to not just celebrate the new trees we put in, but are also taking care of the ones we currently have," Council Member Keisha Hodge Washington said. The plan will not obligate staff to report survival rate or net trees gained, but Office of Heat Response and Mitigation Director Dave Handula said he hopes to discuss these metrics when possible. Ed Herms, president of the Osborne School District Governing Board, which provided input on the city's tree plan, said he was happy with the plan and that it would make a big difference. However, the public will need to keep pushing the city to make progress. "Phoenix is good at making plans, but has had issues with follow-through in the past," Herms said. So what is Phoenix's tree shade plan? The 85-page plan aims to accelerate the creation and enhance the maintenance of shade in Phoenix. It focuses on adding shade, maintaining existing shade, evaluating progress annually, and creating a citywide movement around shade and heat that educates the public about sustainable and equitable shade practices. The report includes 36 action items that fit within 11 strategic priorities. Some of the actions include completing grant programs to plant trees at schools or in neighborhoods, building permeable pavement or using plants and soil in public rights of way like sidewalks to reduce heat, spending more on cool corridors, the high pedestrian areas targeted for shade, building 80 bus stop shade structures per year, and making the permitting process easier to plant trees. The report says the actions explicitly focus on the city's most vulnerable residents and the places where people are outside the most. If the 2010 goal failed, will this be different? The original plan was established in 2010, but fell apart. A lack of citywide metrics, economic turmoil, confusion over the goals, a culture of turnover, and the shifting of responsibilities between city departments stunted progress. The internal team tasked with carrying out the plan inexplicably stopped meeting. In 2021, the City Council pivoted. Instead of an overall shade target, the city would focus on tree equity. That meant planting trees in underserved areas with fewer trees to begin with, schools, pedestrian areas, and bus stops. A factor Gallego and Handula have said will make a big difference this time around is the federal and city funding commitment. The old plan committed no funding. Plus, Handula's Office of Heat Response and Mitigation, which is leading the charge on the shade plan, didn't exist before. The new goals also have a shorter time frame. The document now has 1, 3, and 5-year milestones, which we think will help with accountability, Handula said. "I think having these relatively short time frame benchmarks will be an asset." How will the plan measure success, shade quality? The city largely plans to measure success by the number of trees and shade structures added, the number of trees replaced, the amount of money spent on tree and shade maintenance, and the percentage of trees and structures in good condition. Another metric is what percentage of the plan's actions are completed or underway by year 5. The Shade Phoenix Plan says the city should follow a no-net-loss approach. However, staff won't be obligated to track survival rate, how many trees are lost each year, or net gain, according to the report in Hondula. Certain city departments track this individually. The report says while Phoenix had planted roughly 33,000 trees in the last 14 years, another 21,000 were removed, leaving a net gain of about 12,000 trees. The new plan also doesn't include specific shade canopy targets. The staff is supposed to measure shade canopy percentage, but it doesn't say the percentage has to increase by a certain amount. When KTAR asked the mayor what kind of trees would be planted, whether they'd be little saplings that we're going to have to wait 20 years to get shade from, or are they ones that can produce shade pretty quickly, Gallego didn't directly answer. She said the city would plant native species that grow deep tap roots, use less water, and be much stronger in summer storms. Gallego said the city was trying to help small businesses and get trees that will make an impact as soon as possible. Hondula said he hopes to talk about net trees planted and survival rate where we can, but at this stage, the resources aren't in place to know the status of trees every day. Another challenge for Phoenix is ensuring adequate irrigation for the trees. It's mentioned in the plan as a priority. Councilman Jim Waring urged staff to focus on that. Having trees just planted and then dying is not optimal. It doesn't help with shade. It doesn't help with the look of the neighborhood. So we just need to make sure that maintenance is a key component of this, Waring said. Hondula said the vision is that every tree is set up for success. I think we still have some work to do to guarantee the highest possible survival rate, but that's one of our really big priorities in the immediate future. The plan does call for a comprehensive inventory and overall shade assessment that's supposed to be accomplished by June 2025. The assessment will show where shade exists at different times of day and different times of the year. It will use three-dimensional building and landscape data to help the city identify the best places to build trees. Hondula said the council is set to vote on the contract to establish the inventory in December. Gallego said Phoenix was setting a nationwide example of how to leverage technology to fight back against a collective challenge, and that is urban heat. Here's a recent column from USA Today. Frost Protection for Plants, Tips from Gardening Experts for the Winter, by Olivia Munson. During the frigid months, there are ways to prevent yourself from getting frosty. But what about your plants? How can you protect them from those wintry visits from Jack Frost? If you live in an area where the weather isn't always hospitable, you might have experienced losing a plant or two when the temperatures drop. Sometimes we forget to cover our plants or can't relocate certain crops in time before the weather changes. But there are methods and measures to protect your plants, according to gardening and horticulture experts. Here's what you need to know. How to protect plants from frost. This is not a one-size-fits-all answer when it comes to protecting plants from frost. It depends on a whole bunch of different factors, says Dave Whittinger, executive director of the National Gardening Association. Each area has its own weather and landscape, so it's hard to lump every gardening experience together. Vegetation or flowers that thrive in one part of the country may differ from another. If you're going to plant something in the ground, it's best, if you can help it, to choose something that's designed to withstand the cold in your area, says Whittinger. The best place to start is to look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Plant Hardiness Zone map. The map helps gardeners and growers learn what plants can actually tolerate their specific location, said Cheryl Boyer, a professor in the Department of Horticulture and Natural Resources at Kansas State University. The hardiness zone map uses the average annual extreme minimum winter temperature as a guide to divide the U.S. and Puerto Rico into 13 zones, according to the USDA. On its website, you can input your zip code to determine your hardiness zone. A lot of plants, especially ornamentals, will be ranked according to their cold hardiness zone, said Boyer. From there, you can decide what perennials or plants that live for more than 2 years are best suited to where you are. So what happens to plants in the winter? It's easy to assume a plant is dead if it has become brown and shriveled, but this isn't always the case. We have a lot of plants that, like perennials, will just lose the top herbaceous part, said Boyer. In the soil, the roots will be fine. It'll pop up new shoots in the spring when it warms up again. There is no need to worry if your roses or tulips have seemingly dried up. If plants are in the correct hardiness zone, they will go dormant in the winter and regrow again once the temperatures go back up. Many plants can hold up against cold temperatures. Woody plants, such as pine trees, are usually safe from frost depending on where you live, said Boyer. Another example is oregano, which is usually okay in cold temperatures, said Woodinger. Plant frost prevention methods. If you're looking to give your plants some extra protection from the cold, there are several measures to take. You can place boxes, buckets, or nursery containers on top of your plants to protect them from a light or medium frost, said Woodinger. However, this won't completely protect them from extremely cold temperatures. There are also different types of fabric and plastic options to lightly drape over your plants for short-term protection, said Boyer. If it's going to be an extended period of cold, you want to make sure that the leaves are not touching the edge of the cover, she said, explaining if the leaves come in contact with the cover, the plant could freeze. If you surround it with some protection, it'll have its own humidity and warmth. If your plants are in pots or containers, you can bring them inside your home or in the garage to prevent them from getting frost. Dealing unpredictable seasons. While we try our best to predict the weather, things don't always go as planned. One day could be relatively warm for the season, and the next is back to freezing. It may feel like nature is trying to trick you, but it's not. In these cases, it's best to be scientific about caring for your plants, said Woodinger. If the average temperature is still relatively low, don't let one random warm day or two convince you to start planting. You really should wait, he said. This is the number one cause of people failing in their vegetable gardening is by planting at the wrong time. In general, it's important to keep an eye on the weather via alerts or applications, said Boyer. This will let you know what is coming to your area, whether it be rain, frost, or freeze. From the Arizona Republic, looks good in almost any landscape. 5 ways to plan, make an easy to maintain stone path by Steve Beam. Natural stone paths look good in almost any landscape. They never go out of style, like so many man-made paver materials. Like most things made of stone, they will stand the test of time if they're built carefully. Stone construction is one of the most satisfying home improvement projects you can do for that exact reason. Stone masons are generally a happy and satisfied group because they build things that last, and no two projects are exactly alike. We often see stone paving and stepping stones that have sunk into the ground, sometimes so much that they become buried. Settling can make the stones uneven and hazardous to walk on, and can cause dirt and grass clippings to pile up on them. So how to prevent your stone walkway from cracking? Another common problem with stepping stones is that they aren't hard enough. The wrong type of rock was used. Stones that are laid on the ground will absorb water if they're too porous, so winter freeze thaw will crumble them to bits eventually. Home handymen can build with stone, however, there are some common pitfalls to avoid. Backaches, crushed fingers, and even hernias are a real hazard, so you need to be aware of your own limitations. Having a helper is a good idea, but handling stones is a bit like dancing. Your partner must work closely with you, or there can be bumps and bruises, or worse, injuries if you're not extremely careful. Respect rocks. They can hurt you badly in a careless moment. What is the best stone of a pathway? Here's how to build stepping stone paths that last. First, select dense, hard rock like ledge limestone or granite, at least 3 inches thick. Porous stones like creek rock or fossil rock absorb moisture and then crumble over time as they freeze and thaw repeatedly. How do you make a simple stone path? Dig a trench 1 inch or 2 deeper than the thickness of the thickest stone, wide enough for the widest stones you have. Spread 1 inch or 2 of 1-inch crusher run limestone in the trench and pack it with a tamper until it's solid. This is called a footer. Add 1 inch or so of pea gravel, tiny round river pebbles on top of the compacted limestone, and then lay the stones out on the pea gravel. Space them for a normal stride so that an average person can walk on them comfortably. Now heap pea gravel all around each stone. Using a level, raise or lower each stone so it's level across the top and level with the stones next to it, working pea gravel up under the stone on all sides with a shovel. Wiggle and twist the stone to settle it so it won't seesaw or rock no matter where you step on it. Once you've done this step, walk on the path in both directions to check the spacing and make sure the stones don't move and that there are no tripping hazards. Using a rake, pull the extra pea gravel up around each stone so that there are no gaps under the stones. How to make sure you can mow near or over your stone path. If your stone path is across lawn, take special care to make the top surface of each stone level with the ground around it. This way you can mow over the finished path easily and it won't matter if grass grows between the stones. If your path is across landscape beds, you might want to set the stones higher than the surrounding ground so that you can mulch around them a few inches thick. How to prevent weeds from forming near your stone walkway. Wash the stones thoroughly so that any dirt or weed seeds clinging to them won't wind up on top of your clean, sterile mulch. Carefully stuff mulch between the stones and then spread mulch flush with the top of your path. Brush or blow off any mulch that gets on top of the stones. Now, stand back and admire your work. It's safe and solid on a compacted footer that won't allow it to sink. Because your stepping stones are set on a bed of pea gravel, it will always be easy to level up and adjust any stone that settles or moves out of place. You've made a permanent improvement path that will last for generations. Coming up later this month, celebrating Las Noches de las Luminarias, a tradition of light and community at Desert Botanical Garden. Las Noches de las Luminarias, held annually at Desert Botanical Garden, has become a beloved tradition since 1978. This enchanting event illuminates the desert landscape with thousands of hand-lit Luminaria bags, creating a captivating atmosphere that attracts visitors from around the globe. As the garden transforms into a winter wonderland, it offers a unique opportunity to experience the beauty of the desert during the holiday season. The garden invites you to join this year's celebration, including Luminaria-lit trails, twinkling holiday lights, musical performances, entertainment, and festive food and drinks. The event features live music and performances, ranging from traditional holiday tunes to contemporary sounds. Simply Three, the dynamic trio whose imaginative blend of genres, captivating arrangements, and high-energy performances has garnered critical acclaim, returns to the garden for the first time since 2022. The garden is also debuting a world stage of performers that will include mariachis, Celtic music, and more. Plus, fan favorites like bell choirs, carolers, and harps return. Visit dbg.org to explore the full entertainment schedule. This year, the garden is thrilled to offer an even brighter spectacle with Light Bloom by Hibakusho. The immersive experience explores the fascinating intersection of science, math, and nature through stunning geometric light installations throughout the garden. The talented duo behind Hibakusho, Yelena Filipchuk and Serge Bolio, drew inspiration from the night-blooming flowers that creating an exhibit that comes alive after sunset, blossoming with light and transforming the night into a glowing landscape of art and geometry. Community and tradition. Although Las Noches de las Luminarias debuted in 1978, each year introduces new themes and artistic elements, ensuring that it remains fresh and exciting while honoring its origins. In collaboration with staff and volunteers, then-Executive Director Rodney Engard aimed to create a holiday event that represented the Southwest and complemented the garden's beauty, a gift to the community and an homage to desert plants. In the early years, staff and volunteers worked to light more than 700 luminarias using brown paper bags, sand, and candles. The event has grown from one night to, at its inception, to two nights, and now to 19 nights each winter due to popular demand. Mariachi music was introduced, as well as musical features and innovations to the Luminaria bags, which are now reusable, honoring the garden's commitment to sustainability. Garden staff and volunteers light each Luminatia bag by hand each evening as a gift to the community. Visitors can also dine at Gertrude's Restaurant, reservations recommended, or purchase holiday beverages and other holiday foods along the trails as they stroll the event. If you are searching for a creative gift, stop by the garden shop to explore its offerings, which include art, jewelry, books, and more. Tickets are on sale now for Las Noches de las Luminarias, running select nights from November 29th to December 30th, 2024, and you can find out more by going to the website at dbg.org. And those of you who listen to this show on a regular basis know we feature stories each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called A Gift of Grace. It was written by Amanda Dodson, and there's a quote here from Victor Hugo. The supreme happiness of life is the conviction that we are loved. A gift of grace. As the nurse had instructed, I walked up and down the halls of Mercy Hospital over and over again. I was 17 and pregnant. This was the last place I ever imagined myself. I had planned to become an interior designer and move to New York. Not anymore, I thought glumly. As I walked past room after room filled with husbands and wives, giggles, and encouragement, I was only reminded of how alone I was. I couldn't help but notice the bright bouquets in so many of the rooms. One woman had at least 50 pink roses on her nightstand. The florist delivery man seemed to live on this floor of the hospital. Every time he arrived, I said a little prayer, hoping he'd walk into my room in the back corner, but he never did. I got pregnant the summer before I was to leave for college. My boyfriend, 3 years my senior, was leaving for medical school at the same time. He left on schedule in the fall, and I never heard from him again. My parents were almost as unsupportive. They begged me to consider all the options, but even in my pain, I knew that having my baby was the right decision. They were infuriated and gave me money to have the baby in another state, so you won't be embarrassed. I moved in with my grandparents. They were well up in age and weren't able to go to the hospital with me. So, on that rainy day when the contractions began, I drove there by myself. I had never felt so lonely. I wanted desperately to have my hand held by someone who wasn't trying to prick my finger or take my temperature. As I continued to walk, I passed a room so filled with people, it looked like they were having a party, not a baby. I stuck my head in to see what all the commotion was about and heard a pleasant voice come from the bed. "Hi, it looks like you're getting ready to have one of these." The new mother was holding a beautiful baby in a white gown and a pink cap. "Let's hope so," I said, trying to sound cheerful. I was mesmerized by the tiny baby she held with such confidence and pride. "My name is Laura. Would you like to hold her?" I was so touched by the woman's kindness, all I could do was nod yes. Getting to her was the hard part. Laura had more balloons and flowers in her room than I had seen all day. She had beautiful orchids and lilies, too. The whole room was so inviting, partly because of the flowers' gentle scent. As I held the precious infant in my arms, she cooed and strained to open her eyes. "Are you having a boy or girl?" Laura asked. "I don't know yet. I'm crossing my fingers. I'll find out tonight." I delicately handed back her gorgeous child, praying mine would be as healthy and alert. "Well, good luck. You're going to be a great mom." In my 9 months of pregnancy, no one had ever said that. It was the nicest thing I'd ever heard. Hours later, I lay in my own hospital bed alone, waiting to deliver a child whom I could only offer love. I was beyond scared. As tears fell down my face, I heard a knock at my door. A nurse came in and sat down next to my bed. "I have a surprise for you, Amanda." For a passing second, I thought my parents would stroll in, but instead, another nurse walked in with a bouquet of flowers. It was the most beautiful arrangement I'd ever seen. It was filled with daisies and lilies and baby's breath and even roses. I was so excited I could hardly keep from jumping out of bed. When I thought it couldn't get any better, another nurse came in, her arms full of more flowers and balloons. Nurse after nurse came in until the room was completely filled with every flower imaginable. I felt like I was in a florist shop. I was in shock. Who would have gone to so much trouble to send me such thoughtful gifts? I hurriedly looked at the cards and found they all said the same thing, written in the same handwriting. "You are loved and created with a special purpose. For love." I had no idea who they were from, but suddenly I did feel loved and ready to bear and love a baby of my own. That night I gave birth to a beautiful baby girl. I named her Grace. A few days later, I walked around the hospital as proud as only a new mother can be. I stopped by Laura's room to visit and saw that all her flowers were gone. "What happened to all your flowers?" I asked. She smiled and said, "You are loved and created with a special purpose, for love." I fought back the tears as I realized who had sent my flowers. Only God could have put me in the hospital at the same time as such an angel. Laura told me she had given birth alone years earlier. She said she could sense I was hurting when I passed by her room, so she gave me her flowers to lift my spirits. Little did she know how much her gift had meant. It had given me the strength to deliver my beautiful Grace. Laura has been my best friend for almost 10 years now. To celebrate our friendship, every year on our daughter's birthdays, we send each other flowers. And every year I thank God again for His grace and for mine. That's called The Gift of Grace, written by Amanda Dotson, one of the many stories that make up Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.